The year is 1928. We're in Madrid, and an esteemed poet stands at a podium and addresses his audience politely. And he sets the stage by placing himself along the reed-filled Spanish shore, beneath the yellow tiles of homes and shops, and even at the outskirts of villages where he describes them as places where tigers eat little children. Already he's preparing us for something that may surprise us. Federico García Lorca is walking through Spain searching for songs because he insists a song suddenly leaps from its yesterday to our today, alive and pulsing like a frog, and shedding light for him on who his countrymen and women were and still are. More surprising still is that Lorca was set on collecting cradle songs, lullabies. And he continues, "Some years ago, strolling through the outskirts of Granada, I heard a village woman singing her child to sleep. I had always been aware of the acute sadness of our country's cradle songs, but I had never felt it so vividly as then. Approaching the singer to make note of the words, I observed that she was a pretty Andalusian, happy, and without the slightest hint of melancholy. But a living tradition worked in her, and she faithfully executed its commands, as though listening to the ancient, imperious voices echoing in her blood. Since then, I have tried to collect lullabies from every corner of Spain, wishing to know how my countrywomen lull their children to sleep. And after a while, I gained the impression that Spain utilizes its saddest melodies and most melancholy texts to tinge her children's first slumber. This is not restricted to a single example, a single song from one region. No, every region stresses its own poetic character and depth of sadness in this genre of song. The European cradle song's only object is to lull the child to sleep, unlike the Spanish, which at the same time pierces its sensibility. We should not forget that, as its words show, the cradle song was invented by poor women, burdened with children, a cross often too heavy for them to bear. Each child, instead of being a joy, is a sorrow, and naturally they cannot help singing, despite their love, of their weariness with life." Words of poet Federico García Lorca from a lecture titled On Lullabies, given in Madrid in 1928, translated by A.S. Klein. This all surprises us, perhaps, with descriptions of such songs sung to babies, songs that are lessons in disenchantment. Lines like, "That's the weaver's life, nothing but misery, lule, lule, lule." Certainly, these are songs of experience rather than songs of innocence. When we hear those phrases, songs of innocence and songs of experience, we may immediately think of another poet, this one from England, and he is William Blake, working at a time of great social and political change, as was Lorca, though Blake lived in the 18th and early 19th centuries, not the 20th century, as we're told by the British Library. Poems, they say, that contain unsettling ambiguities. This Sunday, Blake and Lorca will meet, and we're invited to an afternoon of music and readings at the Wyoming Valley Art League. It's a Sunday at the Circle event produced by Jason Smeltzer and featuring a number of his friends and colleagues, a program with selections from Blake and Lorca's poetry and music by noted English composer Ralph Vaughan Williams. The event will take place this Sunday, January 27th at 3 in the afternoon at the Circle Center for the Arts of the Wyoming Valley Art League in Wilkes-Barre. Robert Anderson and Rose Wright are founding producers of Sunday at the Circle. We had a visit from Robert Anderson and Jason Smeltzer, and they spoke with us about the genesis of Sunday at the Circle and this Sunday's program. Robert Anderson.
The story begins in the fall of 2014. Since that time, we have presented 24 performances, plays, musical events, readings, many of them incorporating artwork and props from visual artist members and featuring some terrific talent from Northeast Pennsylvania. Nanticoke native and Broadway veteran Ron Cross, singer-songwriter Brenda Fernandez from Scranton, actors Ann Rodella, Bob Stanley, and Steve Bartolome, readers Tony Brooks, Rabbi Larry Kaplan, and Larry Voitko, musicians Ron Stabinski, Brenda Nyberg, Ray Stedenfeld, the late, great Wayne Smith, and thereminist Jason Smeltzer. The mention of Jason's name brings us to our next event, and also back to the beginning. Following our performance in the fall of 2014 of Another Tempest, in which Jason provided music and also acted, he then was responsible for our very first Sunday at the Circle in the summer of 2015. Gooj Gitterman, the gang of four that Jason rounded up to put on a show, Kathy Wang on guzheng, Steve Brozena on tabla, Mark Reinhardt on guitar, and Jason himself on theremin. What is a theremin? Turns out it is this weird electronic instrument that makes weird sounds and is played without any physical contact between it and the person playing it. Yes, weird. Perfect for Jason. And now Jason has put together another gang for our next Sunday at the Circle event. Lorca Blake.
Yes, we are putting together a Lorca Blake evening. Actually, pretty much everything I've done lately, it comes up, will that work? Is that a good idea? There's always some little concern somewhere. Robert had even mentioned that someone had mentioned, what is the connection between Lorca and Blake? My connection is that there are songs that are Lorca and Blake, and they both work on that weird instrument that Robert was talking about, the theremin.
Now, pause there, if you would, Jason. Give us what we need to know about the theremin.
The theremin was invented in the 1920s by Leon Theremin. It is essentially the first musical instrument to use electricity, only musical instrument that you don't touch. Essentially came with the invention of radio. And that's basically it. You have five octaves in the air.
And you've experimented with its possibilities.
I don't know of other thereminists trying to play Spanish theremin, for example. And that initially came up through another guitarist named Jay Stavetsky. He and I were doing some Spanish and Latin music. And I don't know if I verbalized it, but I figured it'd be interesting, but I didn't think it'd be good. But it's possible. It's actually surprisingly convincing.
Then you already had some sense that the Lorca would work on theremin. The songs, Lorca, Blake, they both work.
Well, it's a contrasting duo. The Lorca will be classical guitar and theremin, and they're essentially, I didn't understand much about them when we had performed them with Jay many years ago, and I still don't know much more. They are things that he resurrected from folklore, essentially. And really, my understanding is the music itself is derived from a wax recording of he and a vocalist performing them. So you really have to work with them. They're not like art songs. In contrast, The motivation for doing a Blake evening is recent discovery of some William Blake pieces by Vaughan Williams. Actually, very sparse, just for oboe and voice. And I love something that he writes under them, just as a warning. And also, these are about the last thing that he did write, but he has a little note. The oboe parts of these songs may, in case of necessity, be played on a violin or, by transposing the songs down a tone, on a B-flat clarinet. But neither of these expedients is advisable. RVW. And last night was the first time that I was able to perform them with, practice them with a violinist. And she was just finally coming to the understanding that, okay, there's no vocalist. And we just have, I'm doing the bottom line, none of these words are present. And as with most things, there are questions as, will this work? She was concerned. So will this fly? And then we played it, and then we played one piece again. And I just looked at her and said, well, I'm feeling something. And it warmed up very quickly. She was very concerned, but we won her over. And how it all connects, too, like there's a nice, since none of it's that familiar territory, it's interesting how intuitively you'll start to connect just by vibe, really.
Now, when Jason and Charles play Lorca's music, which would normally have a singer, it is, as I understand, Jason, the theremin that is the voice.
Of course.
And the guitar is, of course, the guitar, mm-hmm. the instrument.
Like Olivia, who I just took for granted, had the same vision that I was having. And it was funny that bit by bit I was realizing that she was just accepting that I knew what I was doing, but not seeing what I was doing at all. And it kept happening until we actually did it. And in her defense, too, the Vaughan Williams, William Blake pieces, they're a lot less obvious as opposed to guitar accompaniment. Her part is very vocal as well. There's an ambiguity there. We could actually trade very easily. I feel like I'm doing the right thing if someone's apprehensive and very quickly it transfers. If it will work right from the get-go, then you're probably not doing very much anyway. So it's nice to have a little apprehension in the formula.
What drew you to Lorca, Robert?
I knew Garcia Lorca as a playwright, and I knew him as a playwright many years ago in high school. I don't know why they weren't assigned in class, in English class or lit class, but I started reading his plays. I bought his 3 tragedies at a bookstore. He was a very prolific playwright, but I think in this country he's known mainly for those 3 plays, 3 tragedies. Yerma, The House of Bernarda Alba, and Blood Wedding. In fact, I wrote a paper on them comparing him with Tennessee Williams. I also became acquainted just a little bit with his poetry, in particular his collection of poems that were published under the title Poet in New York. And when I became involved with this project, well, we weren't going to do drama. It was poetry, verse. I went back to Poet in New York, and I read a lot more now than I did then, and I was so impressed by the power of this poetry. And I'd like to read something quickly right now from the book that I bought, a very thick book called Selected Verse of Federico Garcia Lorca, the introduction from the introduction by Christopher Maurer. Lorca departed Spain for New York in June 1929 on the SS Olympic, sister ship of the Titanic. Living on a generous allowance from his parents, the 31-year-old Lorca enrolled in English classes at Columbia University and lived in Manhattan. While in New York, he worked on his theater, delivered a series of lectures, went to plays and concerts, walked the streets of New York, and composed the difficult poems that would be published posthumously in 1942 as Poet in New York. A decisive experience in the New World was the Wall Street crash of 1929, described in a moving letter to his family. In Poet in New York, one finds an anguish with both personal and societal dimensions. An intensely lonely poetic narrator with the qualities of biblical prophet and priest raises his voice against the degradation of nature, indifference to suffering, the materialistic corruption of love and religion, and the alienation of social groups such as the blacks. By the time he returned to Spain, Lorca had proven to himself that he could write long, memorable poems in free verse on the most unpoetic of subjects. The title, Poet in New York, was meant to sound paradoxical. In a lecture he delivered in Buenos Aires in 1934, 2 years before his death, Lorca, speaking of the process of artistic creation, acknowledged these three important elements: demonic irrationality, closeness to the earth, and above all, an awareness of death. Yes, his poetry can be difficult, but when I read it, I sense his demonic irrationality, or rather, it seizes me, and I am close to the earth, and I am aware of death.
An interesting thing about Lorca, and those familiar with him, it's interesting that it's not that known that he was a very serious musician. Earlier, when he was in school, he was actually considering a life of a concert pianist, and I believe the story goes that his teacher had passed away, and he just switched gears. One of the folkloric songs that one of my favorites, I'll read a little verse of it because it's very short, and it just goes, "This little turtle has no mother. A gypsy woman bore it and left it out in the street. La 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 la, la 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 la. This little infant has no crib, but his father is a carpenter and will fashion him one. La 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 la, la 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 la." And that's it.
Jason, you mentioned you've used folklore and folkloric a couple of times in the song itself. Gypsy is mentioned. Lorca, wasn't he very much interested in the gypsies and gypsy culture?
I think that's the essence of most of the songs that he revived, that he found. Again, it's always been vague. He and Manuel de Falla, actually, they were friends, and they sort of toured the countryside. There's even a de Falla piece where they use the same motif. There again, I don't know exactly what the explanations are. It's very murky.
When I did my research for Lorca's verse in Poet in New York, I read that he saw or associated the blacks in Harlem with the gypsies in Spain.
Mm. This sense of social consciousness brings us to the fact that many people are aware that, in fact, he was executed.
In 1936, I believe, by a firing squad. 1936 was the year of the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War. Yes.
And Jason, when you heard what Robert read about those three things, does that come through in what you've selected for us?
They tend to be more lyrical. There's definitely an abstraction, but as far as anything, there's a few that are very stereotypical. The arrangements are very respectful of period.
The time that we've just mentioned, the 20th century, 1936, and the Spanish Civil War and the market crash and so forth, William Blake is from another era, another time.
Blake, to me, just has a very surreal thread early going. And the pieces, it's a nice juxtaposition. He has a series of poems of innocence and a series of poems of experience. And the Vaughan Williams pieces are directly from that. They're almost all from those two. So there's this juxtaposition of very awkward, arcane motifs that you just sort of try to be graceful with. But he's, you know, has a little point there where others are very innocent. There's one called The Lamb that's challenging it not to be a limerick. Like, it's not quite cutesy, but at the same time, there's an element of nursery rhyme throughout them. Would you like a Vaughan Williams example? Would you like innocence or experience?
I think we want innocence to compare with the turtle first.
Ah, this is the first one, called Infant Joy. I have no name. I am but 2 days old. What shall I call thee? I happy am. Joy is my name. Sweet joy befall thee. Pretty joy, sweet joy, but 2 days old. Sweet joy, I call thee. Thou dost smile. I sing the while. Sweet joy befall thee.
Thank you, Robert. Very nice.
But now let's get real.
Take us down a notch. This is One of Philip's favorites, too. It's called The Poison Tree. I was angry with my friend. I told my wrath. My wrath did end. I was angry with my foe. I told it not. My wrath did grow. And I watered it in fears. Night and morning with my tears. And I sunnied it with smiles and with soft, deceitful wiles. And it grew both day and night till it bore an apple bright. And my foe beheld it shine, and he knew that it was mine. And into my garden stole, when night had veiled the pole, in the morning glad I see, my foe outstretched beneath the tree.
Very nice.
The Poison Tree by William Blake. And we'll hear Vaughan Williams' music for a song setting of that text on your program. The oboe can sometimes be pastoral in tone. Do you hear anything or feel anything folky in his setting of these pieces?
I would say no. I would definitely say no. The innocent ones as well as the more severe, they definitely hang in the air. There's definitely a 2 inches off the ground element to all of them. There is one that ends with a little bit of a almost very song-like that brings you back home. But other than that, I even mentioned to other people playing them with me, there's a lot of rhythmical awkwardnesses that are, I've suggested that they're deliberately put there just to make sure that it's not a song, just to keep you 2 inches off the ground. But you have to be graceful. That's the trick.
Jason mentioned before in answering about a possible connection between Lorca and Blake, he stressed the contrast. So, Jason, you just mentioned Up in the Air.
Mm-hmm.
If I could, for just a brief time, get down and dirty with a couple of samples from Lorca. This is Dawn. La aurora de Nueva York tiene cuatro columnos de cieno. Dawn in New York has 4 columns of mire and a hurricane of black pigeons splashing in the putrid waters. And this from the King of Harlem. I, Harlem, I, Harlem, I, Harlem, there is no anguish like that of your oppressed reds, or your blood shuddering with rage inside the dark eclipse, or your garnet violence, deaf and dumb in the penumbra, or your grand king, a prisoner in the uniform of a doorman.
Both innocence and experience in Lorca, as we've just heard. We have alluded to some of the people you mentioned, a violinist and Philip Mosley. Tell us who will be with you and how this will all come together for us.
Okay. For the Lorca, it'll be my classical guitar teacher from way back then. His name is Charles Truitt. Always wanted to do some things with him. We've talked about it for years, and it's finally come together here. And also Olivia, a friend of ours, a violinist who did some pretty serious symphonic work in California and retired to this general vicinity in Strasbourg. And there again, yesterday was the first time we actually practiced something together. So it's always nice when moi, who plays a noisemaker, can hold her own to someone who's a symphonic celebrity, basically.
Introduce us to Philip.
We're really missing out on Philip being here. He's the smartest one of all of us, and he has the English accent. And he was actually familiar with these Vaughan Williams pieces. Vaughan Williams is one of his favorites.
And he's a big Blake fan, isn't he?
Right.
And he is a professor emeritus at Penn State.
Penn State.
Scranton. And how about recitation?
Philip and I will be the reciters.
You will be representing Lorca.
And I'm going to be pulling in some other poets, too. Mm-hmm. Allen Ginsberg has a poem relating to Garcia Lorca that I'm just going to read a bit of. And Garcia Lorca, when he was in New York, wrote a poem about the Brooklyn Bridge. And it just so happens that I One of my favorite poems of all time is Hart Crane's Brooklyn Bridge, and I'm just going to read a bit of that. And a terrific poem by Garcia Lorca, it's really down and dirty, is about his visit to Coney Island. So, of course, I'm going to read a little bit of Ferlinghetti's Coney Island, Of the Mind. But I do have a confession to make that there's also a personal connection through my wife. Through her, I once met one of Garcia Lorca's nieces, Isabel Garcia Lorca. It just so happened that Rose and Isabel danced together. Rose was one of the founding members of the Twyla Tharp Dance Company in New York, and at one point they performed one of Twyla's dances at the Metropolitan Museum, moving around, going up and down stairs. And there, a young docent was so impressed by the performance that she asked whether she could join the company. That was Isabel. Her father, Francesco Garcia Lorca, Federico's brother, was a professor at Columbia with a big apartment on Riverside Drive. Her mother was also a professor at Barnard. They both taught Spanish lit. Well, Rose and Isabel not only danced together, they roomed together when the company went on tour. They became good friends. That was all before my time. But once, when Isabel was visiting in New York after she had moved back to Europe, she and Rose got together, and I kind of tagged along. I found her a very warm, wonderful person, and I got to hear a lot of stories.
Robert, take us through a typical Sunday at the Circle performance. When do you start?
We start at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, and this will be January 27, Sunday. And we have free parking. We are right in back of the Bell Furniture parking lot on South Main. We have lots of free parking, and we also have free food and drink. Of course, we welcome donations, but we have it spread out, and when people enter, they can partake, and we always have an intermission. People get up, and they talk, they circulate, they eat, they drink, and then we have the second half of the program. And that's basically it. We're usually finished before 5. And so it doesn't go real late at all. People can easily get home for dinner. In May, we're planning to do some absurdist works. And that would, of course, include Jason.
You and me, if I'm not mistaken.
Robert Anderson, who will read as part of a program titled Blake Lorca. He is co-founder with his wife, Rose Wright, of Sunday at the Circle at the Wyoming Valley Art League, and Jason Smeltzer, musician and producer of the Blake Lorca program. They were here at WVIA to talk with us and to invite us to attend Blake Lorca this Sunday, January 27th at 3 in the afternoon, at the Circle Center for the Arts, 130 South Franklin Street, and that's in the middle of the block, between South Franklin and South Main Street. For more information, on the web, WyomingValleyArtLeague.org, WyomingValleyArtLeague.org. Admission is free, but a free will offering will be gratefully accepted. That's Blake Lorca, with a host of guests. Charles Truitt, classical guitarist from Marywood University, Jason Smeltzer, featured on Theremin. There will be a guest violinist named Olivia Orozzi, and readers will be Robert Anderson and Philip Mosley. And for more information, on the web, WyomingValleyArtLeague.org.